Okay, everybody, we got a lot of people to find and not a lot of time to find them.
Dan, what the hell are you talking about?
It's the Progressive Conservative Party Caucus of Manitoba. Since their historic defeat in the Tuxedo by-election this week, they've all gone missing.
Oh my God, that's horrible. Okay, where do we start?
Okay, we're going to break up into small search parties. Adam, I want you to search the Manitoba Club, the Winnipeg Squash Club, and the Winter Club. Lots of Tories hang out in those spots, and those squash and racquetball courts, when the lights are off, there's lots of room to hide in the corners. And don't forget the steam room as well. And again, I want you to case the PC Party headquarters on Kennedy Street. Knock on the door, but don't forget to look in the windows as well to see if they're hiding behind the curtains.
Okay, where are you going to search?
I'm going to start with ShawarmaCon, the restaurant chain owned by PCMLA Abikant.
I'm not sure there's going to be that many Tories hiding there in plain sight. Why would you start there?
I'm really hungry, and I really love ShawarmaCon.
Now that you mention it, I'm hungry too. Why don't we all start with ShawarmaCon?
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Tansei, bonjour, greetings everybody, welcome to another episode of Negan and the Lone Ranger. Where we are in the shadow of a by-election, but an announcement that may not get as much attention, but is equally, if not more so important, is that it looks like we've got certainly a season time for the landfill search for the remains of murdered missing Indigenous women and girls here in Manitoba. And while there was some rumors that it might begin this summer, it looks like it's going to start in the fall.
Start in the fall. And, I think you have to give the provincial government and to a lesser extent, the federal government, who I think is underwriting some of the costs, I give them credit for going ahead and doing it. They didn't really have much of a choice after what happened in last fall's election when the Progressive Conservatives made such a fuss about how great it was that they weren't going to search the landfill. I think, I think they're doing the right thing. I think I'm worried about the chances of finding something largely because the 6 months that the Winnipeg Police Service waited to tell people there were remains there really has made the job infinitely more difficult. I am, however, more interested to a certain extent in the fact that they're going to build some sort of a healing center and memorial there, because I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, regardless of what they find or don't find at that site has to become a memorial.
Yeah.
And it needs to be taken out of service, and it needs to be, I mean, I know that's not going to be enough to really give peace to the families, but I think it is, I think we're moving in that direction. I think that's a positive thing.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a 2-hectare area, 72,000 cubic meters of waste, and of course, that's just the target area where they think that the remains are. And we've talked a lot on this show how critically important it is that this search be a really important step forward to be able to rectify what has been just an unjust situation, a completely disrespectful situation by many different factors within the city, within the province. And the reality is that there needs to be some kind of peace to the families first and foremost, but then also for Manitobans, because all Manitobans have been impacted by this issue. I wrote a piece about how we saw the first moments of hope when we saw Wabkanoo, our Premier Canoe, and the families of the victims bring ribbon skirts, ribbon shirts to the site, bring color to a site that is very dark. And of course, physically, you can see it as a very gray area, a place in which all of this, not just things that typically go in a landfill, but we're also talking about things that are chemicals, toxic chemicals, mm-hmm. asbestos and things and so on. And there is this kind of moment in which perhaps this monument, this healing center, whatever it's going to look like, because there is a kind of a ceremonial space that's right just on the outskirts of just near where the target area is going to be, that there'll be some kind of peace that can be given, or some kind of recognition that we're not talking about a site about garbage. We're talking about a site about human life. We're talking about a site in which there needs to be some interest and engagement and life put in that area.
Yeah, I think as well, too, this is going to be instructive for members of the public that are skeptical about the science and the technology involved in forensic excavation. You know, one of the worst bits of disinformation that came out from the PC campaign in last fall's election was this idea that it was too dangerous, it was too complex, these things can't be done. The fact is, they're done all over the world. Yes, waiting 6 months to let people know that there are human remains in the landfill has created an infinitely more complex challenge. But one of the things that was happening today is, I think when the announcement was made, is journalists are getting to tour the site. They're getting information about how the search is going to be done. And, you know, we're going to see over the next, over the year probably that follows the commencement of excavation, we're going to see that there are people, experts, who know how to do these things that could have been done more effectively if we'd act sooner, but they're going to see that the people know how to do this and they know how to do it safely.
There was a really beautiful celebration of life for Morgan Harris this past week. Many of the activists who have been in the occupation camp recognized in the value and the importance, and there would have been a time in which to celebrate Morgan Harris particularly because she would have been graduating. And that's, I think we want to honor all those people who are doing that work. And I think that hopefully, while I think this information might be somewhat a little bit disappointing that the search isn't starting immediately, my hope is that there is hands on deck to be able to move this forward. But, you know, there's another story that's really taken up a lot of energy and a lot of time, and that is around the by-election, the Tuxedo by-election. Certainly, you've written a lot about this. We saw a huge, massive moment, I think. I tweeted out that there's something interesting happening in Manitoba because as we're taping this about 2 days ago on Tuesday, we saw the arguably the most conservative riding in the city of Winnipeg, maybe Manitoba, but certainly as evidence has birthed two premiers, the two major MLAs of this region, you know, Gary Filmon and Heather Stephenson, who ruled for nearly 40 years of this.
They held that seat for more than 40
years. More than 40 years. And it was taken over by the New Democrats by about 600 votes, 3,700 to 3,100 in a by-election that had more attention than usual.
Yeah. So a couple of things for context. Number one is turnout was just over 45%, which is strong for a by-election. By-election turnouts can be woefully, woefully small. So this is a pretty strong turnout. But, you know, the Tuxedo normally gets somewhere between 60 and 70% turnout. The NDP actually increased their vote by about 75 votes from what they got in the fall election. So that is a really, really impressive performance. And it does send a strong message. And if I can, you know, I'll try to connect the dots a little bit with the first part of our conversation about the landfill. You know, there were people within the PC party who felt they had to lobby or they had to campaign against searching the landfill. And that in doing that, they were tapping into a constituency that was very skeptical and angry about the money that would be spent on searching the landfill, and that helped them retain a certain level of support within the province. I think, there were a lot of progressive conservatives concerned about the legacy or the lingering impact of things like that. I think that's part of what we saw this week in Tuxedo is, and the way I put it in my column was that, you know, this was a riding with one of the strongest underlying foundations of progressive conservative support, and they broke it. They broke the riding.
Completely. Like, it is, I mean, it's almost brain numbing to realize that Tuxedo, and you know, I grew up and I think people all know that my father, worked with Howard Pauley, former Manitoba NDP premier out in Selkirk. That riding is now almost forbidden, almost forbidden riding for NDP, you know, held for a long time by Howard Pawley, then later Dewar, but has been really a former Reform Party, Canadian Alliance, now Progressive Conservative. I mean, that's federal. I'm mixing federal and provincial politics together there. But I mean, that is an almost impossible riding to imagine. And growing up in the, you know, 1990s, 2000, sort of surrounded by, I can't even imagine what that riding would look like as an NDP riding, but it used to be. This is a riding that never at any time in history was even close to being an NDP riding. And was it ever close? I see.
No, I don't think it was. You know, there may have been, and sorry, listeners, that I should have done more research on this.
No,
I think that Gary Filmon might have had one semi close result.
For stat fans, prior to the 2023 Manitoba general election and this by election, the closest that the Tories came to losing Tuxedo was in 1988. When Gary Filmon beat Jasper McKee of the Manitoba Liberal Party by only 124 votes.
Okay, so I did. It was kicking around in the back of my head that there was. Thank you to the
fact
checker, Negan and the Lone Ranger research department.
Just expanded. I'm so impressed.
That's right. Like we're, you know, we have a deep and broad expertise that's cramming.
Did you get Adam? Did you get that from our hundreds of staffers that were quickly sorting through all of the documentation?
I was inundated by information.
With the Google machine was in play. Last fall, of course, Heather Stephenson only won the seat by 263 votes against what is known in the business as a paper candidate. So the NDP did not want to spend a lot of money in they didn't recruit a high name candidate. No disrespect to the person that put their name on the ballot, but it was they were a sacrificial lamb and came within 263 votes. The NDP spent $1,500,
Which barely covers like signs.
That you know, if you've got three kids these days, that's like a trip to Costco. You know, like.
That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're meat eaters, it's like, you know, a $1,500 trip to Costco and tires. You probably buy tires.
So now what we have is we have I was spending time talking with some NDP people who are on the ground canvassing, and they said two things. One is that there still is a very staunch amount of support for conservatives in that riding. And they saw it at the door. They saw people who were very angry, very upset, and almost took it out upon the canvassers that arrived at their door, because people certainly were feeling that this was going to be a change election in that riding alone. The second thing that they've noted is that the person who has won, Carla Compton, she's a nurse. Yeah. She's not maybe the most shiniest candidate or well-versed candidate. Writes or speaks very much from notes that is she may or may not have written. Maybe it's given by party insiders. Is a person who doesn't have a whole history in politics. That's an interesting choice. And I think everybody, even within the NDP, is curious as to whether this is a big statement on the NDP's focus of healthcare. And then in a broad sense, the kind of realization that the current Minister of Health, Minister Azaguera, might need some support or perhaps healthcare experience to be able to govern in that portfolio. So I'll be interested to see where new MLA Compton will be headed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's every reason to believe that maybe not in the 2027 general election, but in the election after that. I mean, sooner or later, I think the Progressive Conservatives are going to put up a huge fight. Right now, like a party that governs for a certain period of time and then loses an election rather badly, like the PCs did last fall, it basically collapses all the internal structures. So you get, you know, it's more difficult to raise money. It's more difficult to get top people, fundraisers, strategists, and others to volunteer or lend their time to a campaign. There are fewer people that want to work with the leader. And let's remember, this is a party without a permanent or a full-time leader right now. And I think that, you know, there's always, when you lose an election, there's always kind of a sense of, could it get worse, right? Like, are we at the bottom now? I think the PCs are closer to the bottom now. I do think that the other major shoe to drop from this this by-election loss is going to be we're going to see a very limited field for the PC leadership. Had they won Tuxedo, I think you would have seen more people in the race. This is me arguing that I'm going to be right against something that never happened.
That's right.
But that's what we do in the journalism game.
Well,
the
one thing you pointed out in your column that I thought was so interesting was that the impact of this by-election, and do by-elections really do have impacts on leadership campaigns, I think certainly shows that there's going to be an impact, because the reality is that Now the BC party is almost completely cut out of Winnipeg. There's only two left.
Yeah.
Only two MLAs left for the Conservatives in Winnipeg, which tells you that there is a even stronger rural-urban divide. And the question is where do you go with your leadership there? Do you go with an urban leader who, frankly, will be in an island, if anything, in the city of Winnipeg? Or do you go with a more rural leader, which then almost completely cuts yourself out of what is an increasingly progressive, engaged, and NDP almost blanket in the city of Winnipeg? Like, do you further yourself completely by going to what is your base, or do you turn towards and try to find your votes back in Winnipeg?
Well, in the two solitudes that make up the Progressive Conservative Party, the rural and the urban, the rural types are going to be pointing out, and they are not wrong when they do it. Gary Filmon, Stuart Murray, Hugh McFadden, Brian Pallister, Heather Stephenson ran the truck off the cliff. Thelma and several Louises, like five or six Louises.
Measurement.
Yeah, that's right. But, the idea that, the urban progressive conservatives have dominated leadership campaigns. And, I should say, Brian Pallister is Mr. Portage La Prairie. He didn't represent Portage La Prairie when he was leader. He had a seat in the city. So we're going to consider him an urban,
sort of.
But I mean, he is, I know that he doesn't listen to the podcast, but, for the historical record, he is a farm boy. He has deep rural roots. He has a close and deep affinity with Portage La Prairie. But even so, a bona fide rural candidate, somebody representing a rural riding, has not really in modern PC history has not held the membership of the party. So I think the two solitudes of the party are going to have a battle, but it's also extremely awkward now to figure out, if someone from outside the party, outside the elected caucus, wants to run for leader, how are you going to get them into the legislature? There's only two seats remaining in Winnipeg. And after the results in Tuxedo, the party has to be worried about either of those people resigning their seats to allow new potential leader.
Yeah, what will happen
leader.
In the by-election for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, like that would be risky. And then outside the city, particularly if that person from outside the caucus is an urban person, I can't see many of the rural MLAs wanting to give up their seats. All of this comes back to one of the main points in my column. Heather Stephenson announced in April and that she was leaving in early May so she could take a seat on the board of WestJet. And the timing was great for Heather Stephenson and really sucked for the party. I don't know. I mean, there would have been an argument for and against her waiting longer. But if she had somehow made it through the very, very brief, like it's like a 5-week fall session, and then waited, and then right before Christmas, the holiday season resigned, then Wab Kanew, out of honor, of these things, would have had to push the by-election past April 2025 when the Tories have their leadership.
And would have been much more interest in, certainly they would have had probably a wide slate. They would have been much more present in the media.
Now, on the downside of the equation, there's a lot of frequent flyer points available to people who sit on the WestJet board. So, I mean, that was in play as well.
The question is she using their brand new ultra basic fare?
I have a feeling
me
not, considering
not.
Have you seen?
Yes.
No comment.
Moving on.
I will tell you this, though. Yeah. You know, because I've been doing graduations all week, right? Mm. So I've run into a Premier Canoe a number of times since Tuesdays. In fact, at the University of Manitoba today, his wife, Dr. Lisa Monkman, was honored by the as getting a faculty award. Nice. And so he was in the audience. I have never seen a guy. It's almost like he's floating on air right now.
Well, these are salad days, honeymoon period, days of wine and roses. I mean, choose your lyrical metaphor. It's good now. You know, a year from now, still probably be good. You look back to the Gary Doer years, won the 99 election and then kicked ass in 2003 and 2007. I mean, just laid waste. And so I think that, that's a hard trick. Ask the Manitoba PCs about how hard it is to win three elections in a row.
I can just tell you that I've never seen the guy so happy. And, I guess it will more to come. And one of the great things is that this relates a lot, particularly in our feature guest for this week. So you did such a amount of heavy lifting to get this guest. We had to be flexible.
There were five, maybe six emails that went back and forth. I mean,
this was a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. Dr. Joss Reimer, a lot of people will know her because she was a prominent person in the pandemic. One of the leads on the vaccine implementation task force, and a regular participant in the daily Zoom briefings that became standard fare for journalists and others who were locked at home. And she was recently elected as the president of the Canadian Medical Association, which now makes her a medical thought leader and opinion leader with a national profile. And she was good enough to bike all the way here from her office on Main Street to the studios at Portage, Maine. And here is our interview with Dr. Joss Reimer. We're really quite blessed this morning to be able to interview Dr. Joss Reimer. I'll explain in a moment, but she wears two major hats right now. She's the Chief Medical Officer for the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority and recently began her term as President of the Canadian Medical Association. So that makes her a national figure in the discussions and debate about healthcare. For those of you who may not have heard about her before, you may remember Joss Reimer showing up to many, many, many Zoom news conferences. She was the official spokesperson and one of the architects of Manitoba's vaccine task force. In addition to that, she's been the director of population health for the undergraduate program of the medical school at University of Manitoba. She got, in addition to a medical degree, got a master's in public health and served for a time as the medical director of public health for the WRHA. She's lived all over the world, speaks three languages. Which languages do you speak?
French, Spanish, and English.
Okay, way to go. She was recently, or in recent memory, voted Humanitarian of the Year by Doctors Manitoba. And she also maintains a clinical practice in gynecology and obstetrics and apparently still catches babies in the middle of the night, or so your bio says.
I help out the obstetricians. Okay. I don't do full scope obstetrics and gynecology, but I'm there to help them.
So the obvious question is, it appears that you've had trouble holding down a job. but it is for people that rise to your station in the hierarchy of health, it usually comes with multiple hats, right?
Yes.
Like that's, you know, so explain to me the interaction between Canadian Medical Association and WRHA. The WRHA is the largest health region in the province. It's also, I think I'm fair in saying, from a media perspective, it's fairly tightly controlled. It's not that we can't get access to people. It's just that, you know, we have to give blood and fingerprints. And no, that's entirely true. But the CMA is you're an advocacy organization. Part of your job is to be constantly interacting with media and special interests and others. So so what do your WRHA bosses think of you taking on this job? And is there any concern that, you know, you're going to play hooky every once in a while, go out and you know, you're going to be outspoken on the one hand and you're going to be very tightly controlled on the other. So how are you going to manage those two roles?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is I'm actually on a leave of absence from the Winnipeg Health Region, because I wouldn't have been able to do justice to both jobs. They're both more than full-time jobs, with more than enough work, to go around in both of those positions. Although I am still doing some contract work with the WRHA, so not completely separate from them. But I think that the point you're making about the difference in the messaging and the control and media relation is definitely there. And I did have conversations with the CEO, with some of the politicians at the time when I was running. We've had a new government since then, because I wanted to be very clear about my intentions so there was no surprises. I have and will always be nonpartisan. But that does mean sometimes I'm going to say things that the government of the day may not be a fan of. And that's not something you can really do when you work for the government.
No.
So that conversation had to happen very early on about how in that role, there were going to be things I was going to say that whoever was in government may not like. So they were very aware and supportive. But also we were very clear about, I'm going to have to make it very clear what hat I'm wearing when I make certain comments. Because it is different and the role is different. One, you're advocating on behalf of doctors, but also of everybody in Canada. And the other, you are representing the organization and trying to do the best for serving the population in that one city. And sometimes those two can conflict.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to, and I couldn't definitively say that you're the first or the third person to come from the public system into the CMA role. Although typically, historically, it's been a doctor in private practice, or someone who's private practice in maybe academics as well. So my first reaction was though that the CMA is actually getting a unique insight into the public system. Is that part of what you're hoping to bring to the CMA, is kind of that inside baseball for like how government works?
Yeah, I also don't know if I'm the only one to have ever done this, but certainly recently the only one. And it is quite unique. A lot of the previous presidents come from the provincial or territorial medical societies or medical associations. And so they've been on the lobby side, the advocacy side, sort of the whole time. Whereas I still see myself as an advocate, but have often spent more of my time advocating internally instead of externally. And this is quite a switch to be advocating so much externally. But I also came in having worked every day with politicians, having done a lot of media. And so I had a very different experience coming in than some of the previous presidents who had, you know, never met with a politician or very rarely. Whereas I'm sitting there going, you know, talk to the premier and the minister of health almost every day for a good year when we were in the depth of the pandemic, and had a good look at, you know, how does government work and how are they making decisions? Why do they make some of the decisions that they make? And that's really, I hope, going to inform the CMA on how we can be strategic about, you know, finding ways to achieve the best possible outcomes, knowing that politicians have to make decisions a little bit differently than many other people might make decisions.
No, for sure.
And that, I mean, that's also like a real specific Manitoba experience, isn't it? Because if you just look at right next door in Ontario, or even I think I would feel comfortable saying this about Saskatchewan, definitely Alberta, but the way the medical systems work versus government is quite distant, especially in Ontario. I wouldn't be surprised at all that a regional health authority head would not meet with the premier or would really only speak on a emergency basis. I mean, in Manitoba, kind of everybody knows each other in some way or another. And if you don't, then you go to the same events together. Or and you grew up in Winkler, right?
I did, yeah.
So, I mean, it really is. Manitoba is one of those interesting places where we have one major city. Everybody comes to it, Brandon, not to insult our listeners in Brandon, but that when everybody kind of circulates around a center, I think that creates a lot of institutional knowledge that might otherwise not exist in other provinces. Are you going to bring that to the role too? I mean, this kind of there's a mentality, I think, about being in a place in which, you know, everybody knows your name, to work together and maybe, and also bring that to a sort of a national scope.
it is a really interesting experience being from one of the smaller provinces. And I imagine that, you know, the Atlantic provinces probably have a similar experience, although they don't always have the same sort of one city. But one of the recent presidents, you know, came from Whitehorse, where I think that their Minister of Health is also their Minister of Finance. So they work closely and all know each other, and they all live in the same community. And so it is quite different from province to territory about how these things go. But, you know, the last two presidents were BC and Alberta. So they're going to have a very different experience.
Yes, it doesn't surprise me then if they're private practice, if they're distanced from the government. I mean, that's interesting. And I think particularly that we are still in the throes or areas of the pandemic and lots of challenges ahead when it comes to healthcare. And we think about if there is a change in government federally next year, then there'll be certainly a shift in direction for healthcare. Now, there's lots of things to criticize about the Manitoba healthcare system. And I think that you've been at the center or another. You just have to do a quick search to say in lots of circles, you're heroic. In lots of circles, people maybe not so much. And people often use the term the healthcare system is broken.
Yeah.
And in many ways, as the head of the largest regional health authority in the province, certainly the where all the centers are, where all the technology is, where all of the major operations are. I'm thinking about just if you're a First Nations person, you're ending up in the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority at some point. If you break a leg or if you have a disease or if you have diabetes, whatever. What do you say to that? What do you say to people who say the healthcare system is broken and now you're going on to another job? That may be a criticism that might follow you and go, hey, you know, the Manitoba healthcare system, I had this bad experience and you were the head of it at the time. What would you say to that?
I mean, I think the health systems across the country are in crisis. When you talk specifically about the First Nation person that comes in, they're also colonial structures. So they were built to serve some people much better than they were built to serve other people. And even the people who they were built to serve are at the moment not being particularly well served. So I think there's a lot of improvements. What brings me a lot of hope and optimism is the people who work in the systems, because there are so many passionate people who are on those front lines, taking care of people, trying to work despite the system to make sure they're taking care of people, helping them either through some of the worst moments of their life or getting them out of the worst moments of their life and getting them back to being healthy. So there's lots of improvement. There's no question, you know, when we're talking Winnipeg specifically, we look at our ER wait times. They've been horrible. They've been, you know, heartbreaking to watch and see people have to wait for the care that they absolutely need. But I also know there's some really wonderful people in the system who are working very hard and have lots of knowledge and expertise about how to move things in the right direction. Unfortunately, these are slow systems. So, you know, the pace of movement is not what any of us would like to see. And some of that I absolutely own. I was responsible for 2 years for all of the physicians in Winnipeg. And you can't have a job like that and please everybody. There's no way. But I hope that I was a net positive. I think that's my goal is to do more good than harm in some of these big, impossible roles. And I hope that people see that, that even when they may disagree or when I made a decision that they don't think was best, that people recognize that, you know, my intentions are to serve Manitobans, serve Canadians, and make the system better for all of us.
So this next question, I mean, I think we could probably do like a whole part two just off this question, but I'll see if we can't navigate to a more concise answer. So, okay, so healthcare in Canada is in crisis. And, you know, certainly the pandemic features into the situation. But there is evidence to suggest that we, if we weren't in crisis, we were very, very nearly in crisis when the pandemic hit. I mean, what's the line from No Country for Old Men, you know, it's a mess, but if it's not a mess, it'll do till the mess gets here. I mean, it was horrible. And so we were trending downward. So notwithstanding the impact of the pandemic, how did we get to crisis? With all of the billions of dollars and all the public debate, there have to have been some absolutely colossal mistakes made in either judgment or policy or fiscal management of the system. How did we get to crisis?
It's tricky in Canada because we really have, we don't have one health system. We have like 15 different health systems because we have several federal systems and then each province and territory has their own system. And they move in different directions, doing different things all the time. And in some ways that can be helpful because you can respond more to the local needs. But sometimes it just makes things complicated and confusing and adds a layer of complexity and inconsistency and inequity that is hard to overcome. And working at the federal level now, getting to look at all of the systems, not just Manitoba, has, you know, opened up some of the perspective of how we all face very similar challenges and we don't have enough healthcare workers. That's true across the board. There's not enough physicians or nurses or respiratory therapists. That's a big one that we don't talk about, but we're really short on. And in the 90s, one of the things that we did is we cut back on training of healthcare professionals.
That was the big the paper from the academics in Montreal. Doctors and nurses were driving up healthcare costs, so
yeah,
we need fewer of them.
Yeah.
Unbelievable now.
Yeah, and so we can see the numbers in Manitoba. We cut way back on our entry into medical school. I think we were down to as low as 70 graduates a year, something around there. And now, because of that, we're so short, and so we're planning to go up to 150 per year. So like more than double what we had in the 90s because we're so short. And those decisions were consistent across the board. Everybody was cutting back on healthcare providers. And that might be a good decision when you're thinking in a 4-year cycle and you just need to get elected again. But that's not a good decision if you're trying to plan 20, 30, 40 years into the future.
So what's the version of that between 2010 and 2020? Because you can look at expenditures going up, not always steeply in Manitoba between 2015 and the pandemic arrival, it flattened right out and, you know, funding grew at less than the combined impact of inflation and population. So it was essentially a small cutback in funding. What is in that era, what were the mistakes that we made that are comparable to this misguided cutting back on medical school and nursing school admissions? Is there one or two things that we did wrong?
I think we didn't focus enough on areas of prevention or primary care and mental health. Those three areas could be cost saving if we put more dollars into the community, into the organizations that are actually, you know, working directly with people who know what they
need.
And
the money went more to tertiary, like hospital care and
instead of tertiary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's really easy to put money towards the emergency room, the ORs, the hospitals, because those are so visual. Like you can see the facility. And when you're in crisis, that's what you need. But what we want to do is keep people out of crisis. And so rather than constantly responding to the crisis, so constantly looking at the ER wait times and thinking, okay, we need more ER docs. We don't need more ER docs. We need more family docs who can keep people out of the ER because their diabetes is being better managed. Because when they do have, you know, a cut, they can go see their own family doc. Or when they need a prescription renewal, they can go and get that done. So not only are they not getting their primary care in the emergency room, but they're not needing as much emergency care because they have better basic care that prevents those things. So I think that in the last, you know, couple decades is where we've seen not enough funding on the prevention side, the primary care side.
Okay. And Manitoba wasn't the only government that did this, but
nope,
they tried to bend the curve of funding in the second half of that decade. And I've certainly said that that was a foolish assumption even without the pandemic arriving. But does it now look like that? The assumptions that were made that they could do that they could bend that curve, that was foolish policy?
You know, if you look at the strategic plan for the Winnipeg Health Region, they really talk about prevention. They talk about primary care. They talk about all those basics. But if you look at where the money has been coming recently, we're responding to crises. Mm. And that's not a criticism of the decision makers there because there are real crises that they have to respond to. But it does mean that we're sort of perpetuating the same challenge because we're putting more money into the crisis and not into the prevention. And when you're in that crisis, what option do you have? People need that care. But what I really want to see is more investment in into the community, into prevention, into primary care. And I don't by that mean necessarily family docs. I'd like to see, you know, physician-led primary care teams. I'd love to see everyone in Canada having access to a primary care team as a way that they get their basic care, so that, you know, maybe they're seeing the doctor, but maybe they're seeing the dietitian to talk them through, you know, how do you eat for, you know, if you have diabetes, with a low cost option, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe seeing a physio to help with your hip pain.
You better be careful, because people start calling you defund the hospital or defund the because that's exactly,
but just for the next year after that, it's no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Please write that headline down. CMA president says defund the hospital.
But please don't say that. I'm just,
but no, like that is precisely the yeah. argument that people use for not just healthcare but policing. We've talked about on this show involving all sorts mental of institutions. I mean, yeah. the real challenge for homelessness is never just houses. It's what the big term is wraparound services or whatever. But being proactive rather than reactive,
yeah.
and that's an indigenous healthcare system right there, which is how, I mean, was far more interested or as much interested in pancake breakfasts as they are with removing children. And what we're talking about here is not just, I mean, we need to absolutely shore up ERs and ORs and so on like that, but we also have to give people a place to go when they're in crisis. So anecdotally, I just had an experience. I won't get into too much of it. I mean, I think it was well read and we've talked about it. My father's experience in the ER during the kind of later stages of the pandemic. Very negative experience with a hospital here in Winnipeg, in the ER waiting while in heart failure, you know, 25 hours just to see someone. So very concerning, very upsetting. I've just spent the past 3 days in the exact same ER, new government. I'm not giving them credit or
you
criticism.
You didn't see the health minister?
I didn't know. No. It was not even, the health minister was not there.
Okay.
The premier was not walking through the OR. So, I mean, the morale, the services, the wait time is also significantly different, but this was also a different scenario. Every wait time is different because it has to do with the healthcare of the patient. But the morale is really what you notice, the difference. And are you noticing that as well? And recently, because of course you're leaving, going on to another post now, is it really the issue as much, not just funding, but also trying to do what's often been called a culture shift within the healthcare system. And that culture shift is then giving people the kind of hope that you're talking about, people who are dedicating themselves again, maybe coming back from the private sector.
I think I would say I'm seeing pockets of hope. So pockets where the morale is getting better and where, you know, people are seeing the light and at the end of the tunnel and seeing that all this effort is going to good things. But I would say even more than that, I'm hearing from people across the country who are just burnt out. And so as much as I'd love to say, yeah, I think everything's getting better, I'm still hearing these stories all the time across the country about how stressed healthcare providers are and how they feel like they're putting all of themselves in to support a system that is failing them, failing the patient, and the moral distress that they feel on top of the burnout. I mean, burnout is a complex thing. It's not just about how hard you work. It's also about how meaningful your work is, about how valued you feel.
Relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. So these people who are working long hours, but also feeling like their work isn't valued or they're not being listened to, that's where you really see the burnout. So I am, you know, personally so excited to hear that in one of our sites here that I was responsible for, that things have gotten better, because I absolutely did see improvements in some of the settings within Winnipeg. But I think that there really are still pockets and we've got a long way to go.
So what do you think is the legacy that we've just learned over the past 5 years? And it, perhaps now you, I hope, have a bit of, you know, it's hard to see the forest for the trees, you know, when we're still in the middle of it. And you certainly still are in the healthcare system in various different ways. But what is it the big thing that we've learned? Is it that pandemics aren't just about giving people vaccines or medicine when they're sick? Is it about caring for each other? Is that what it is? What's the big takeaway from the past 5 years of this pandemic. We're now in, we're coming up to the fifth year pretty soon of when the pandemic started in 2020, March 2020. What is it that we learned from this past 5 years?
Well, I've got sort of an optimistic and a pessimistic response to that. I'll start with the pessimistic so we end more positive. I think one of the things that we saw was that there's always people who are willing to take advantage of a crisis for themselves. And we saw a lot of people sharing misinformation and really causing harm to the community for their own benefit. But what we also saw at the same time was communities really stepping up and taking care of each other. And that was remarkable to see. The having that front row view from the vaccine side, where I saw some of the greatest success was really where we weren't the decision makers, where we were handing over the money, the power, all the resources to the community to say, how do you want to serve your community? If we're going to try to get everyone vaccinated, how do we do that? And where the communities really took the lead and said, our community is going to work by doing, X, Y, and Z. And we're like, okay, great. Let's do whatever you think it is. Here's the resources you need to make that happen. So for me, one of the biggest takeaways was the value of the voice of the community, of the patient, and making sure that systems are informed by them, and not just informed by them, but where they're really a structural component of the planning process. Because when we make systems however we think they should be and they don't work well for the community, then they're just a waste of money.
So further on the pandemic, I mean, the people like yourself that were involved in deploying a pandemic strategy, whether it was social and economic restrictions or other public health measures, the management of healthcare assets, vaccines, we were watching, although I hate the when somebody says there was no playbook. There actually was a playbook, but nobody had really bothered to kind of look into, there were all kinds of warnings about amassing supplies and doing things. And, those warnings were largely ignored. We in the media were trying to provide real-time criticism to real-time decision-making. And I'm sure that it was, I have no doubt that the media commentary and coverage was a source of great concern at times, as the misinformation was. Although I also think too that we managed to point out some important things. And, I think along with some people from outside government, we were able to affect some change in direction and some things. What did we get right on the pandemic response? What can you look back and say, wow, not because nobody was prepared. We didn't have enough stuff. We didn't have enough people, expertise, maybe to what did we get right? And then what were the hard lessons we learned about what we did wrong?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of both of those things we got right and things that we can definitely learn from and do better. One of the things that really impressed me was how quickly we managed to sort of bring people together and focus in on the same issue. And it was very early on that we had, set up teams who were very focused on different areas and quickly had an incident command that was structured and able to respond much faster than healthcare usually responds. Like I said earlier, healthcare usually is a slow moving beast and change takes a long time. But, we really brought everyone together and focused in on the issue and made very fast changes. I've never seen approvals happen at the speed that they happened during the pandemic. It was really wonderful to see the focus in and everybody pushing towards the same goal. We all just wanted Manitobans, because I was working in Manitoba, wanted Manitobans to be protected. We wanted them to be safe and be healthy. And that was so dramatic, coming from before where you work on the same policy for years. That was really exciting to see. One of the things that I think we need to learn from is how important it is to keep some of that preparation in between crises. Because one of the things, we didn't have enough PPE. We just didn't. We had a bunch of stockpile stuff and it had all expired. One of the reasons we couldn't use the stockpiled masks is the rubber bands on them had disintegrated. So you couldn't attach them to your face. And so we need to make sure that we are looking when things are calm at still investing in the prevention and the protection side of things. And that is hard for governments to do because it costs money and you don't see an immediate gain from it. And so it's very hard to convince somebody, yeah, you know, let's spend money on masks or ventilators or whatever it's going to be for the next pandemic. We need to have some of these basics in place, even though we don't need them today. And that's a hard sell, when you're looking to get voted in. and so what we've seen happen before and I hope happens to a lesser extent this time, but we've seen, you know, after a crisis that, you know, you get big funding into public health, into prevention, and then after the crisis, it sort of starts to trickle and dip down and go lower and lower. So, you know, after SARS was when they made the Public Health Agency of Canada and was well-funded for a little while, but then that started to sort of drift off. And so when this pandemic started, they weren't well-positioned, as well-positioned as they could have been to really lead the country through this because they just hadn't had the investment over the last, you know, few decades that would have made them ready for something like this.
I mean, when you were talking there, I kept thinking, hearing the sort of mass paranoia across the entire country when everyone's like, what do you mean we don't have a vaccine manufacturing center and we have to rely on these international centers to be able to provide vaccines? I think people then just sort of realized the infrastructure or lack thereof within the country for basic healthcare are basic things that they otherwise would not be emergent or the reactive elements of the care system. So, there's also something that happened during the pandemic that was remarkable. And I don't know if people outside of Manitoba, maybe outside of the Indigenous world would understand, but the sharing of data and the ability for First Nations, particularly Northern First Nations, to control that information, broke down what was a massive history of mistrust in the system of, that really became this linchpin or this template for how to decolonize a system almost overnight. You know, the fact is that the healthcare system is deeply untrusted by most First Nation people, rightfully so. I can just talk about sterility. I can talk about forced sterilization. The number of, you've been an advocate talking about pain when entering uterine devices into women and the amount of just absolute problems when Indigenous people enter the healthcare system almost from the first moment because of racism, because of systemic racism and all this other thing. Anyways, so like the fact that was broken down almost overnight, the issue of a province and First Nations working together on an issue so sensitive because the provinces hold so deeply healthcare. And then suddenly they're willing to just hand information over to the First Nations because it's all hands on deck. Do you see Manitoba as being that template for maybe looking at other ways that can offer Canada solutions on Indigenous issues, perhaps, but also just generally on the issue of healthcare? Is there things happening here that other people can learn from that are very specific to this place?
I think that the sharing of Indigenous data and the way that the Indigenous communities led the rollout of the vaccine is one of the things I'm most proud to have been a part of, and I was a small part, because the whole point was that people like me shouldn't be making decisions and running things. But it was so dramatic to watch the shift in perspective from all the decision makers and leaders who usually get to make all the decisions, watching them be okay with handing off that power and seeing a better outcome than we would have had if people like me had been left holding all the cards. Because that's always been, you know, the fear in decision makers. They always feel like if they give away the power that bad things are going to happen, or, you know, and that's not what happened. It was exactly what the First Nations communities have been telling us all along, that, you know, we know what's best for our communities. We can provide for our communities. We just need you to, you know, resource it because all of our resources have been taken away from us over hundreds of years. And it was so wonderful to watch that unfold. And globally, we became one of the leaders in race-based data, and particularly Indigenous data, because we looked for other Indigenous data around the country to, not country, around the world to try to inform, like, how do we make these decisions about, you know, who gets access to the vaccine or what sort of treatment regimens or who should have the different medications at what age. And there was so little available. But what we had in Manitoba was so unique. And I have to credit, you know, Marcia Anderson and the Oncommonswomen folks and like so many amazing Indigenous leaders who really stepped up and saw this crisis as an opportunity to move something forward that had been, you know, pushed and lobbied for and worked on for so long. And we got it through. And now we're actually collecting that data in healthcare facilities on an ongoing basis. It's something we never did before, partially because, as you said, Indigenous people rightly don't trust the system. And so handing over data is a scary thought because it has been abused in the past. But also because the system didn't value it. And now seeing both the trust from both sides has been remarkable. And I really do want other jurisdictions to see what we were able to do here and the benefit it's had for First Nations as well as other Indigenous communities in Manitoba in being able to control their own information, but actually have information. Because a lot of times, you know, we had researchers who would show up in communities and say, here is something I studied about you, now you have it. And instead, you know, we've been able to say, well, what do you need to know? How do you need to know it? And how do we help you get there? And it's been amazing.
So, and I don't want to discount what Nagan identified and what you have elaborated on is like a real success story from the pandemic response. So I'm not going to discount that. I am going to point out that as a jurisdiction, we had a somewhat woeful end result from the pandemic in terms of the number of people who succumbed to COVID. Now, I think that, again, we were learning and offering our own insights in real time as decisions are making in real time. But there remain some really, a couple of really strong impressions. Number one is the fact that a lot of accomplished medical professionals who worked outside government in the pandemic response believed that the pandemic response was deeply, deeply flawed. And they offered lots of criticism about what they thought government was doing wrong. That was an almost universal theme that government amassed its experts and did the best that they could, or, you know, made the decisions they could, but that people from outside that group who were equally as qualified were almost diametrically opposed in some of the decisions that we're making. So every pandemic response is going to be a combination of the disease, what government does, and what the people do in response to the government's response. Why did we suffer? I'm going to put it in lay term, perhaps more than our fair share of fatalities from COVID. And is there any connection? Like, do we have anything to learn about decision making and who we bring in to advise us on things? And maybe even perhaps how much of it we leave to the political level of government and how much of it should be invested in the medical professionals. That's not too big a question, is it? No, I could break it down into seven other questions, but yeah, sorry.
It's impossible to tease out health outcomes from all the social determinants of health. And we know that Manitoba has, you know, pretty big income disparity. We've got, you know, a lot of racism that happens in, structural racism in our systems. We have, you know, a lot of people who don't have access to food and housing and all the things that they need to be healthy. And where we saw the impact was really people living in crowded housing or who didn't have adequate housing or didn't have access to food in a way that was, you know, meeting their needs, who couldn't afford to take time off work when they were sick, even though that's what was being, you know, required of them. They couldn't do it or didn't have childcare. And those were the factors that had the biggest impact. When we look at the data, that's, you know, age was the number one predictor of bad outcomes, but all of those social determinants of health were major predictors as well. And so I don't know that there's any way we'll ever be able to tease out to say, you know, was Manitoba's response better or worse? And is that why we had the outcomes? Because the population and their experience and the environment around them is so different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But what I can say is that the data really did show that, you know, people who didn't have access to all the resources they needed to be healthy were the ones who experienced the most harm.
And that outside criticism or, input, because some of it was just input, but a lot of times it was, you know, full page ads criticizing the government's response. How much of a pandemic response should every time the final decisions be left up to the political level of government, which is the legal structure in Canada? Is there an argument from our lived experience in the pandemic that really medical professionals really ought to be, have the biggest say in what happens? Not the only say, but the biggest say, because they don't right now.
I mean, we live in a democracy, and that's the government mechanism that we've set up. And that means that, you know, sometimes people vote for governments that I don't agree with, and I work for them. So it's hard for me to really say, you know, what Manitobans should or shouldn't do, because the way we've set up our system is to try to choose some representatives who get to make those decisions. That said, we have seen some successes in other countries where some arm's length organizations can do really great things because they don't have to worry about the 4-year cycle, and they don't have to worry about getting
real. New Zealand is the best example of that. Yeah.
So there's certainly some examples where arm's length organizations, when given decision making power, can do some really wonderful things. That's going to be difficult for any government to be willing to give up. So would I like to see healthcare providers have more decision-making power? Absolutely. I absolutely would. But I also know that I function in a democracy, right, and it's set up the way it is because this is how Canadians have set it up. And so, you know, I want to work within it, even when sometimes I don't like it.
Yeah. I personally would be satisfied if, when a major decision is made, that we would identify who made the decision, because that there was a real difficulty, you know, because you've got First Minister or Health Minister, you've got Chief Medical Officer of Health, you know, you've got all these people around, and they're all, yeah, this is what we're going to do. Really, if, you know, in New Zealand, one of the great things was we knew exactly who was making the decisions there. So if it was unpopular, they knew who to get mad at. And here it was, you know, pin the tail on the decision maker. So I don't know how you feel about that, but I would be happy if politicians are going to reach, you know, decision, to have the politician stand up and say, I've taken all the advice and this is my decision now.
Yeah, most of the public health acts, they're provincial or territorial, and most of them, I mean, I haven't read all of them in detail, but most of them do have the politicians still having sort of a final say. But that does differ from province to province to territory. So we did see some differences in
some
different
variations on accountability.
We did. I mean, we saw some where the chief public health officer had, you know, very little decision-making power, where they were an advisor and nothing else. And I think Manitoba is somewhere in the middle of all of that. You know, that's the public health acts that we have. And so I'm not aware of any within Canada where the chief public health officer can make decisions completely unilaterally.
I mean, there were places in the States where county medical officers of health or state officers of health had that decision-making power. In most instances, governors overrule them.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So, like, it, you know.
Yeah. And potentially, I mean, elections are elections, and sometimes they're momentary decisions that then we have to live with for, you know, David Frum was giving a talk the other day here in the city and said probably the most influential element is probably going to, in the next federal election in the United States, is probably going to be abortion and Taylor Swift. And so that, I mean, then people have to live with that decision for 4 years. That often happens in the moment. We're coming near the end of our interview, so I have two hopefully quicker questions, but they're pretty serious, especially when it comes to the subject. I was out with some friends the other night, and the subject of who's got the most updated vaccine came up.
Is that a drinking game?
They were all Indigenous peoples, because this was a very important element of our life at one point. All hanging out, sort of saying, okay, who's got the most vaccines? I've got 5, I've got 6, and who's now scheduled to get the next one? The amount of people that use when they talk about the pandemic, and we've done it on this show, in past tense, right? Mm-hmm. Imagining that this whole thing's over with, and maybe it wasn't so bad after all. Those, you know, many of us didn't have direct people losing a life. In the indigenous world, it's almost impossible. Every one of us knows somebody who died, you know, really big singer in our community, Shingus, Curtis Johnny, he passed away. And so this is this real gaping hole in our music world, in the indigenous music world, among many other people. Will people take the next pandemic seriously? Will they get a vaccine? Because I think that because of the vaccine rollout, perhaps in many circles, especially in the indigenous world, I think worked in many different significant ways for, you know, the group of people I was with had 5-6 vaccine shots. Will people take it seriously the next time around? Because perhaps the problem with success is that people might think, oh, it wasn't so bad.
Yeah, I remember specifically during the pandemic, there was some pro athletes who were making some comments about how it's not so bad. Why are you shutting down our games and all of that? And I just thought, like, who is less affected than a pro athlete? Like, you have all the money.
You're super people.
You're really healthy. You're young. You probably, your whole family is fairly healthy because there's going to be some genetics to that athleticism. And I was just like, yes, I'm sure you haven't seen, the major suffering that is happening. But let me tell you, there are some communities like what you just talked about where in the indigenous community, everybody has been affected. So there are some communities where they're very much like, no, it was a huge deal. I lost my uncle. I lost my sister. And I mean, the short answer is I don't know how people are going to take, if it's too soon, I'm very worried about the backlash and the feeling of people not being willing to be restricted again, being told what to do again. You know, we obviously saw a very vocal minority. It was a small number of people, but they were very vocal.
And they're the only ones still talking about vaccines. I mean, that's the problem, is that the people who, for whom it worked and probably saved their lives, are just kind of living their lives. But the anti-vaccine movement is still pumping very out loud, the material all the time.
Yeah. And when I became president, they noticed me, and I've had a lot of messages from that community in the last,
just welcoming you to the job.
Yes, and, yeah, very friendly messages. And
it's not worth laughing about, but it's also indicative as someone who equally receives messages, especially when I do an interview, but not just about vaccines, but about everything. It's really the loudest people, but it's also indicative of change. I think when people are feeling as though they really have to be very loud, that's usually when you notice things are working.
Yeah, and some of the people who are very loud are really people who are facing a lot of challenges, and whether or not what they identified as the problem really is the problem for them, I don't know. But it's, you know, they're being loud because life is hard for them. But there's also a lot of their leaders where, you know, they're being vocal and encouraging this because there's a lot of money to be made too. Mm-hmm. The anti-vaccine world has a lot of money. You can sell supplements and diets and
magic bullets.
There's a lot of money in that world. You know, just being a speaker at different events. So there's a lot of people who are being kind of brought along. I mean, not a lot. There's a small number of people being brought along and sort of being taken advantage of for an even smaller group who are making money off of this. And that's what I find the most frustrating, is I can take the criticism. That's fine. I've made lots of mistakes, and I'm very open to people flagging those. It's when, you know, you're seeing what you know is people who are hurting, and you see they're being taken advantage of and really adding to their hurt, whether they realize it or not. And that's just heartbreaking. When you're a physician and you went into this because you want to help people, and then you just see this whole world where people are being led astray for, you know, money, really. It's incredibly frustrating. So I don't know what's going to happen in the next pandemic. If it's really soon, I'm certainly very worried about people's willingness to go through everything we went through again. But at the same time, I also was so incredibly impressed with the community and what people were willing to do to take care of each other. And hopefully we've learned a bit about it being effective. But you know, with prevention is always the problem, is if you prevent something, nothing happens.
If you succeed, then people maybe don't see the impact. Okay, second question.
Yeah.
And I hope you take this in the best way possible. That's a great way to start a question, by the way. You know, congratulations on your Humanitarian of the Year award from Doctors Manitoba. And I think also CMU, the Canadian Mennonite University, honored you recently. It's hard not to notice that you're not just a physician. You're also a public person and a person who came out to step up for Manitobans to lead the vaccine, one of the people that lead the vaccine rollout, as well as many of the other things that you do publicly. You've talked about some of your own struggles, for example, with mental health and running and ways in which you've been able to engage. All of that is to help people. It's all within the realm of being a physician. But I might also ask you, it's hard not to see the public work that you're doing, particularly running for this Canadian Medical Association, as being something maybe you have interests politically, maybe you have interests in something not so much working in a hospital or in a medical regional association, maybe something else. What are your steps? Do you have a plan? Can we break news? Do you have a goal in mind that, or are you just riding the wave right now?
You know, I've been wrong about my career so many times. I started off in political science, and then went into medicine and started in obstetrics and gynecology, thinking I loved that. That's when I had my worst burnout, and ended up in public health. So kind of back to the political side a little bit. And then was not working in vaccines and then the pandemic happened. And even I was not planning to be a spokesperson. I had joined the vaccine task force 4 days earlier and then got a call saying, you need to get to the ledge. You're doing the press conference in 90 minutes. And I was like, I'm sorry. What?
You were volunteered.
I was like, I'm doing what now in 90 minutes? And they're like, yeah, they're going to get there. And when I got there, they handed me a speech and it said, hi, I'm Dr. Joss Reimer, the medical lead of the vaccine implementation task force. And I was like, I'm what?
Yeah.
And it just became true. And I'm so glad it did, because it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my career. But I'm not looking to become a politician. That's not...
Because you're sure, if you ever thought about it, I can hook you up. You just tell me what party...
you have to be careful talking to Dan, though.
No. But I mean, I know people from all... I can hook you up, no problem, so...
That's not the plan.
Okay.
But, you know, I also know that I've been wrong about my plan many times. So where I go after this, I have no idea. I loved the people I was working with at the Winnipeg Health Region. So going back to that role is, you know, the plan right now. But if I'm wrong about that and something else really interesting comes up, then I'll ride that wave too. So,
well, that's quite a disclaimer. I've been wrong about everything.
There you go.
But yet, vote for me to be the CMA president.
Yeah.
Was that your election speech?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Right. I'm sure the anti-vaxxers will love that too.
Well, just a huge miigwech for coming on the show. You know, if you come a few times, you get to be a friend of the pod.
Three times. Do you five times you get a t-shirt or?
Well, see, that's so funny you asked that. Everybody wants to, I mean, we are right now negotiating with billion-dollar corporations who, with many sport companies, to get t-shirts made. No, we did not. We actually went and phoned a t-shirt maker and said, how much to make five?
Perfect.
Nice. So maybe if you come back, you might be a friend and maybe one day we'll have a t-shirt.
It's a pretty good selling feature. All right, I'll be back.
Yeah. And let me tell you, if you're willing to wear the name of our podcast on your back, you are brave in so many different ways, okay? For another conversation. So.
But a big miigwech. I know you're very busy. In fact, we were very happy that you're so flexible to switch the days on when we were able to do the interview here and come all the way to the CJNU studio, hang out with us and Adam over here in the bowels of Winnipeg.
It was great. I've never been here before, so this was interesting to be in the studio.
Yeah, it's the podcast showcase window to the to the traffic.
It is interesting doing a podcast with people walking by.
Yes, it is. Well, that's why you may have seen my eyes flash every once in a while. It's hard not to. Yeah, thank you so much for coming. Best of luck. Currently president of the Canadian Medical Association. Soon, we think, maybe to be back at the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority, but she's been wrong before. So, thank you so much for coming by.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was just a pleasure.
What a great interview with Dr. Reimer, president of the Canadian Medical Association.
She was a very good sport, eh?
Yeah, I know. She was a good sport. And I will say as well, too, person of national importance, kind of a politician in her own right, showed up, with no entourage and
no notes
and no notes and very So I mean, I think that she is destined to, beyond her term as CMA president, to do some great things. And you know, with a little bit of luck, as she moves up the hierarchy of whatever ladder she chooses to climb, she'll come back and do the podcast.
I hope she becomes friend of the podcast too. Yeah. And so thanks to Dr. Reimer for coming out and dealing with, especially our question about what's next for you. I mean, she's literally just starting the position. So, miigwech to her. Thanks to everybody as usual, particularly Adam here at the GGNU studios, all the great people. We actually have some people right now waiting to get into the studio. So thanks to all them for being patient with us as we get our recording done. And, also big thanks to, Wendy Sawatsky and Paul Simon. Yeah. Paul was on stage with me this week at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, and really we did a great event over there with Stephen Boris, who's the head of the gallery over there. Big and thanks
now,
to everybody.
And now we're off for ShawarmaCon.
Let's go to ShawarmaCon. We are on our way.
On our way.